Good. So welcome back. So yes, I want to explore this particular lecture of Sangharakshita's called Is a Guru Necessary? And it was a lecture that he gave in 1970. Quite a while ago. 20 years later, he had some more reflections on the lecture that he gave in 1970. So in 1990, he had some more things to say. Sort of reflected his latest thinking about the topic. And at the end, I'll read you something from the 1990 lecture. And the 1990 lecture is called My Relation to the Order. My Relation to the Order. Both these lectures should be available on Free Buddhist Audio. It's a particularly rich lecture, Is a Guru Necessary? So I'm not going to be able to do it justice. But I will try and draw out some of the points that he talks about. And of course we'll have time for questions and things, so you'll have to keep thinking. And Ollie very kindly has offered to be my scribe. I don't know what I want written up there, but Ollie will work it out. So that's good. So, is a guru necessary? So you have to just take your mind back to 1970s, when perhaps the word guru was even more resonant than it is now, when, you know, a whole generation of young people were looking for alternative ways of living and turning to Eastern mysticism and gurus. You know, everybody was going out looking for gurus, and Bhante, Sangharakshita, Bhante as I call him, as we call him, as we refer to him, starts off by saying that the very word might evoke images for you. Images of snow-capped mountains in remote valleys, images of caves under the snow line. I don't know if that is what you is evoked, but maybe it was in the 1970s, and of monasteries in these distant mountain valleys. Stone monasteries, and perhaps wise old men with long beards who were inscrutable and occasionally said profound things. So maybe that's the sort of evocation of the word guru. And what he says is that he's going to just dismiss all of that. That's not what he's talking about at all. He says, we're not going to indulge in pictures of this sort. We're going to leave them aside, at least for the time being, rather ruthlessly, he says. And he wants to explore the matter of what a guru is, and more pertinently, what a guru isn't, in much more, principial terms. Now, a guru... the word guru might not be so current in our modern day kind of language, so you might have to substitute your own kind of word for guru. That might be teacher with a capital T, somehow a spiritual teacher who's going to act as a guide or something like that. Okay, so first of all, what Bhante says is that we need to understand what a guru isn't. In order to start to understand a little bit more what a guru is, a true guru is, we need to be very, very clear about what a guru isn't. And he says that we're going to explore what a guru isn't under four headings. And so I'm going to read these four out, and maybe Ollie could take that cue and write them up. So... first of all, a guru is not the head of a religious group. And I'm just going to read all of them out and then we'll explore them. So a guru is not the head of a religious group. Then secondly, a guru is not a teacher. So having just said, think of the word teacher, don't. A guru is not a teacher. A guru, thirdly, a guru is not a father substitute or a mother substitute. In this lecture, Bhante tends to talk of the guru as he, but he does refer to female gurus and leaders as well. But in the 1970s, it was more common to just use the masculine pronoun, so you'll have to forgive him for that. So a guru is not a father substitute, but you could take that as a mother substitute. And finally, the fourth thing that guru is not is a guru is not a problem solver. Not a problem solver. So that's intriguing, isn't it, all of those? And we're going to go through them, but I just wonder if, before I tell you what Bhante says about why a guru is not one of these things, well, as we go through them, it'd just be interesting to see what you think. Yeah? So let's start with a guru is not the head of a religious group. What do you think he's getting at there? Can you think about what that means? Why?
Maharishi.
Say that again?
Maharishi Yogi was born.
The Maharishi, yeah.
Well, he was a head of a religious group.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He was also taken as a guru by...
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah. So one of the things that Bhante is talking about is a true guru is not the head of a religious group. So I just wonder if people could explore what that might mean, why he'd say that.
Is he maybe talking about hierarchy? Mm.
Yeah,
and
why
is
Yeah.
About not having a hierarchy.
Right, right.
Is he talking about authority?
Yeah, who said that? Yeah, yeah, yeah. He's talking about both of those things, I think, hierarchy and authority. I mean, one of the things that what he defines group in a particular way, and at this class we've sometimes explored what Bhante means by group. He's redefining these terms for his own exposition of Buddhism. And one of the ways that, well, what he says a group is, at least in this context, is a group is a number of non-individuals organized into a power structure. A group is a number of non-individuals organized into a power structure. Now, by non-individuals, he's contrasting that with individuals. And individuals, he gives another definition for. Individuals, in Bhante's terms, are people who are creative, responsible for their own lives, responsible for their own behaviour, able to not only think for themselves, but to be in relationship with other people, be their own people, without being defined by the values of the group around them. They're individuals because they're creatively thinking for themselves and living for themselves. That doesn't mean that they're just rebels, because a rebel, if you like, is still defined by the group that they're rebelling against. That's still a group member. But an individual doesn't need to rebel for the sake of it, but nor do they need to conform for the sake of it. They are truly just thinking of themselves. And Bhante says a true individual is, well, he likens that to an enlightened being. So for him, the word individual has a lot of relevance for the spiritual path. We're trying to become more and more individual. And a sangha, a community, is a collection of those individuals relating to each other as individuals, but finding that they've got harmony between them because they share these values of individuality. So he contrasts that spiritual community, which is a collection of individuals relating as individuals in harmony, with a group, which is a number of non-individuals organised into a power structure. And that's where the hierarchy comes in and the authority comes in, because a group in this definition is... needs a power structure because that's what keeps them together. Yeah? And then you, if you've got a power structure, you have a head of a power structure. And that head of the power structure is an authority, well, as you were saying. And it's easy to mistake this guru concept for the head of some sort of organisation or group. Yeah? But that's not what a true guru is. So does that make sense? Do you?
Mm-hmm. Can I just ask how that applies? Mm. Are we not in a part of a religious group here?
No.
The LBC?
Yes, you are. Yes, you are.
You as the head of the group.
Well, no, I'm glad you asked that, actually. There's another term that Bhante uses. So you've got group in this slightly pejorative sense. Well, not slightly. It is just pejorative. Yeah, group. Then you've got the spiritual community, which is a number of true individuals relating to each other. And then you've got something in between the two, which he calls a positive group. And what he calls a positive group is it's a collection of people who aren't relating on the basis of power, but are relating on the basis of supporting individuality to emerge. They're supporting each other to become more truly individual. And that's a positive group. And you could say that the Tree Ratna Buddhist community aspires to be a positive group. Yeah? A positive group in that sense. And you could say that the order at the heart of that community, the Tree Ratna Buddhist order, aspires to be a spiritual community of individuals. Now, we fall short of that. A lot of the time in the order, we're not a spiritual community. We sort of slump down to just becoming a positive group. And sometimes the Tree Ratna Buddhist community isn't really a positive group, and sometimes we just collude and become a group. You know, every time we sort of just collude with each other, not on the basis of trying to support real growth and development, we've descended to the group level. But the ideals are nevertheless there. And a centre like this, a sangha like this, is trying to be a positive group where we support each other. Yeah? Good point. But a guru is essentially not to be identified with the head of some group. Because, I mean, one of the things that Bhante says is that... you often find that people are very devoted to that head of this group. But he says when you look a bit more closely, you find that they're not devoted to the head of the group as the person, as a person, but simply what they stand for. They're devoted to some sort of title, if you see what I mean. They're devoted to the title and the position. It's almost like the person just becomes a symbol. So, the Pope is the head of the Catholic Church, or the Dalai Lama is the head, or was, of a particular branch of Tibetan Buddhism. And people can just relate to the title, if you see what I mean, regardless of their contact with the individual. That's not to say that the individual is a bad person just because they're the head of a group, but that being a head of a group doesn't make them a guru, a true guru, because you could have a head of a group who's just good at being a leader of a group. You know, to be a leader of a group you probably need all sorts of skills, including organisational skills, including all sorts of skills, and depending on the power structure, it might be that actually they're quite a corrupt individual, but they're just good at playing the game. So you can't identify the head of the group as a true guru. Yeah, Ben.
There's quite an interesting film, I think, called "Everyone Must Help," about the Pope who's elected and he loses his nerve and he runs off and tries to hide in a department store.
Right.
And he says, "I'm just not up to the job."
Right.
and he goes into psychoanalysis to find out why. And
right.
And actually, it's, of course, it's very funny, but there is a kind of serious message in the film as well, which is that paradoxically, he takes his role as Pope so seriously in terms of actually really the idea of helping the human race, that actually he has a complete crisis. Not actually because he is a bad, but because he's really thought about what it actually really involves.
It's sort of taken the role and the symbol, as you say, too literally, perhaps. Also, what Banti goes on to say is that you might think that the head of a group symbolises some sort of spiritual leadership, but in a certain sense, possibly all that they symbolise is the group itself. So they're just a figurehead for the group, the collection of non-individuals organised into that power structure. In that sense, you can't necessarily just say that they're a true guru. He says that one way you can tell if people are just relating to their head of the group as a head of group, if they've got the wrong end of the stick, is if they get angry when their leader is criticised. Because what happens is that if they get angry, that sort of betrays that they feel criticised themselves, as if their leader is representing them. Yeah. There's a story he gives from the life of the Buddha where there's this monk who's travelling somewhere on foot along the road, and he's travelling. The road is a bit of a dangerous road, so therefore he's travelling with a number of other people also walking that way. And he's a disciple of the Buddha, but the others aren't in that collection of people. And as they're walking along, he hears some of the other... He's sort of overhearing conversations from his fellow travellers, and some of them start criticising the Buddha. In India in the Buddha's day, the Buddha wasn't universally loved and popular. He did have his critics. And so some of these people are sort of saying, oh, he's not the real thing, they're sort of criticising in all sorts of ways. And this monk finds himself getting more and more indignant and angry inside. And he's sort of, the more he hears, he thinks, how dare they, they don't know who he is, and how dare they say that, and malign him, and da-da-da-da. He gets really, really angry and worked up. And... some days later, he goes to see the Buddha and says to the Buddha, guess what? These people were saying this about you. They were maligning you. And he sort of expects the Buddha to also be indignant. And the Buddha just says to him, look, what have I told you about anger? What have I told you? Anger does not help along the path to enlightenment. Non-anger is what helps along the path to enlightenment. So what are you doing? You call yourself a disciple of mine, and what are you doing? You're not listening. You're just getting angry. And then he goes on and says, look, when you hear criticisms of me, why not just be objective? Why not just say, listen to them, and if the criticisms are true, do something about them when you hear criticisms. And if they're not true, don't get bothered. Why bother? Either way, there is no place for anger. So just, the Buddha was completely sort of unmoved, sentimental and unreactive about his position as the head of a sangha, if you see what I mean. He didn't identify in that group way. So can we? I just wonder if we can think of groups that we identify with, where we might get angry in that way or indignant if our group was criticised. Do Can we think of any groups?
In politics.
Politics, yeah. Politics is based on this, isn't it? Very much allegiance to power structure. You know, the prime minister or the head of the party being the leader of a power structure. Yeah. Politics, yeah.
Either between political parties or even within them.
Or even within them. Yeah, even within them. Yeah.
Families.
Families, yeah. Yeah, rival. Or with, again, within families or within sort of rival families. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Young people. I'm not part of that. But why do I get a bit cheesed off when people go on about young people to this?
Yeah, yeah. Or as a collective, you mean? Yeah. As a sort of generalisation. Mm. Yeah. Well, that's more like a generalisation, isn't it? That's not very valid, rather than a group itself.
Yes.
Yeah.
Workplace.
Work. Did two people say workplace? Yeah, work. Yeah. So we can become very aligned to the company if it is a company that we work for, even a depart. If it's a large company, even a department within the company that we work for, or about our identity. In that workplace, you know, we relate as a group member.
Teachers.
Yeah. Well, that's one example. Yeah.
Countries.
Countries and nationalities and nations. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And you know, it's easy to kind of do that. I was at the Paralympics on Saturday, and one of the real joys of being there for me, anyway, was being in the stadium watching the athletics, and just such a positive atmosphere where no matter what the nationality of the medal winners, everybody was really being celebrated and cheered and encouraged, and it was just fantastic. And people weren't identifying on nationalistic grounds, you know, everybody standing up for the Azerbaijan anthem. Yeah, it was just fantastic, lovely kind of thing to do. So yes, it's worth thinking about. We do belong to different groups. It's worth thinking about how strong does our membership of a group define our sense of who we are. Yeah? It's not that you have to leave your workplace, your political party, your family, blah, 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 but ideally you stop identifying so strongly as a member of that group. That can't be what a human being ideally is. Yeah? We can't surely be identified completely by our group membership. And if we are, we've limited ourselves. And probably we start polarising with other groups. Anyway, back to the text, back to the thing. A guru is not a teacher. A guru is not a teacher. So I think that's even more interesting. So what do you think Bhante means here by a guru is not a teacher?
I think maybe he's pointing towards... with a teacher, you're expecting all the information to come from someone outside yourself.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas with a guru, maybe they're more of a facilitator. They would make you search within yourself by asking you the right questions to come up with answers yourself.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, I think that's it. I think that's it. He's saying that a teacher is normally somebody who has some information or knowledge to impart. And... you know, they're trying to just communicate their knowledge. Whereas a guru, a true guru, is, as you say, well, interested in your growth and development and helping you discover the truth of who you are. And it's not simply a case of knowledge transfer. The Buddha said of himself... that he had no views, he had nothing to teach, he had no philosophy of what's going on in the universe, he had no metaphysical position, he had no views. Around him were, you know, in India of that time, there were all sorts of teachers with all sorts of metaphysical positions. Some theistic, some non-theistic, some saying, you know, the universe was eternal, some saying it was... had a beginning and a creation, etc., etc. And the Buddha said he had nothing to teach. He had no views. The word for view is drishti, and he's said to have no views, no drishti at all. And then, you know, in some suttas, that's emphasised even more, where in one sutra, a Mahayana sutra called the Lankavatara Sutra, the Buddha says that since the moment of his enlightenment, when he discovered the truth, to the moment of his passing away, his parinirvana, or the death of the physical body, all of that time, he's not uttered a single word. He says he's not uttered a single word. And of course that's a metaphor for saying that he didn't impart knowledge in that sense. He doesn't have any views, nothing to impart.
Isn't that a bit misleading? Because he does
teach stuff. Yeah. So what's he saying there then? Because obviously there's volumes and volumes of words that he is said to have spoken. So what does this sutra get at? What is it getting at?
I think it's because the reality is there is nothing, it's only the practice.
Yes. I think that's getting at something. Anybody else want to say?
Well, I think he's saying that it's all there already.
Yeah.
It's not as though somebody needs to give you something.
Right.
All of it is, as it were, available.
Yeah.
Because we're already in it.
Yeah.
We're already in a world governed by these rules. It's just right. That you need help seeing it, possibly.
Right. So again, it comes down to practices to uncover it.
Yeah.
For yourself.
Yeah. Yeah.
Isn't he teaching the practices?
Does it need teaching the practices? The practices do need teaching, that's true.
But I guess in a slightly less strictly literal way, he could say that if he invited you to pay attention to your breathing or something, that what he's highlighting is things that really are there, not that you're adopting or going out and acquiring.
Isn't he saying that what he says can't be taught, it can only be experienced?
Yes, I think that gets to something at the heart of this, I think.
I think as well we have to consider that the practice is something individual.
Yeah.
It's experience different for each person.
Yeah.
So you cannot teach something that is different, is something for me,
yeah.
But it's going to be different for you.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you have to experiment your own practice.
Yeah. Well, that's sort of true, isn't it? That's sort of true. It's like, I often find this when I'm leading teaching meditation, that each person, I'm very aware, will be having a very different experience. And so anything I say might not apply to everybody. But nevertheless, I can teach something like the mindfulness of breathing, or the metta bhavana. And the structure or the form does apply to everybody. The experience within that meditative form will be individual. But I think it comes back down to, well, for me, I think what he's getting at here is that reality is ineffable. Absolute reality is ineffable. Now, the Buddha did teach means to enlightenment. He did teach practices. But those practices are merely method. They're fingers pointing to the moon, aren't they? They're not reality itself. So what's been got at here is that in terms of a metaphysical absolute position, the Buddha is saying, you can't say a thing. There's nothing to say. Reality is just this. Wake up. Yeah? But you can have all sorts of tools and methods to enable you to wake up. And that's what Buddhism is. That's what all the teaching is. But he's distinguishing, I think, between method, which is relative, and absolute truth, which cannot be talked about. Because anything you say is wrong. Yeah, it's beyond concepts.
Yeah.
beyond concepts. So I think he's talking about that level. So in a simplistic sense, he's not a teacher. He's more like a guide. He's not a teacher in terms of imparting information, absolutely. All right, moving on. A guru is not a father or mother substitute. So what's been got at here, do you think?
Moral authority.
Moral authority, yeah. Say more.
Well, a guide in what in the direction you think you ought to be going in.
Right.
Especially if you've rejected the one that was sort of given to you.
But then don't they guide you? Doesn't a guru guide you in morality?
Well, less didactically.
Right. Right. Maybe not in a didactic, forced way. Yeah.
Maybe sort of emotional need or
yeah.
Comfort or
yeah.
Kind of something that's missing that you need.
Yeah.
Or as a protector.
Yeah. Or as a...
There is not a protector. He's not there to shield you from any harm.
Like
a mother or a father would.
Yeah.
He's asking you to put yourself out there and to find a way to deal with it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and all of those things. Go on, what?
The guru is not responsible for you.
Right.
Like a father or mother is responsible for
right,
you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. So often, I think we want all of those things, don't we? We want somebody else to take responsibility for us. We want an authority to tell us how to live our lives, even though we might not do as they say, but we want somebody to tell us, even if that's so that we can rebel. We want this emotional security. Perhaps we want sort of unconditional acceptance and love. In the way that, you know, our parents might have, well, ideally would have given us, but often fall short of, and we're looking for that. And we want this sort of protection sometimes, don't we, from the world, so that may no harm come to us, as if we can be shielded from reality, from impermanence, from suffering. We want somebody to just look after us and make sure we're all right. Sorry?
Protect us.
That's right. That's right.
I think as well can be that the affective link, you know, when you are teaching,
mm-hmm.
Can be contaminated with feelings. Okay.
With
when you feel you cannot have this kind of thoughts about your mentor, because it's going to be affected, the teaching.
Yeah.
The teaching to be poor, okay?
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
Because it's not easy. You want to the teacher become on another level, like when we say about the head of religion. No?
Yeah.
No? When you, the people love the God.
Yeah.
So you can become blind in the belief when it's feelings.
Well, I think that's true of all of these, that it's really important that we don't let go of our responsibility. And if we relate to a guru in the wrong way, I think this is what you're getting at, correct me if I'm wrong, if we relate to the guru in the wrong way, one of the things that we can easily do is give over responsibility for our lives to somebody else, yeah? And that can't be what spiritual growth and development is about. And we can easily do that if we're relating to the guru as a parent, or a substitute parent, or the ideal parent, the parent that we never had but want. From the guru's side,
yeah.
Yes, well...
That would be an abuse of power.
That's right. It's very tempting, isn't it, to take on these roles from the guru side. Be a teacher, be a father, mother, substitute, etc., etc. And in a way, I'm going to come back to that at the very end when Bhante talks about his own relationship with the order. But yes, that's true. That's true. Primarily, this lecture, he's sort of viewing it from our side, looking for a teacher, how to relate. But I think you're right. There's also the problems of from the guru's side. Yeah.
Does that also come back to that you don't see the real person with your relationship as the final mother substitute?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, in a sense, you're projecting on someone else and you're not seeing the real person.
Yeah.
So that's probably in some way stopping you from relating.
Yeah.
In a sort of individual to individual.
Exactly. In a real individual way, in a human individual way. Instead, you're relating to a projection of your own making. And maybe they're also relating from that projection, sure, but somehow it's false either way, or partly false. And all of these are sort of to do with that sort of projection. But the father-mother one, I think, is particularly... seductive, because we all, you know, want this reassurance and guidance and protection. And he talks about how in India, you know, he visited many teachers, came across many Indian gurus, they were always referred to as, the men were referred to as Bapuji, which means father or grandfather, and the women were referred to as Mataji or Ma, which means mother. So even in the language, you referred to your guru as father or mother. And he talks about how he came across one sect, one where the leader was a woman, and all the disciples called her Ma. And Ma literally means mummy. And their main practice was to gather in the evenings, or this is how he saw it, mostly male disciples, all gathering, young men, and they would chant for several hours, Ma, Ma, Ma. So sort of mummy, mummy, mummy. And that would be their main devotional kind of practice. And Bhante saw that as unhealthy. Well, that's what he's made. So, you know, he's saying that, but this isn't uncommon, because he says that we grow up physically, don't we? We grow up physically, but often we don't grow up emotionally. Emotionally, we can remain quite young. And so, you know, then we want this parental substitute. So it's quite easy. We want somebody to depend upon in that emotional way. And of course he says, you know, it's interesting that in Christianity God is referred to as our Father. And I think in theistic traditions, often that God, the God, can become that big parent.
And the Holy Father.
Yeah, and the Holy Father, that's right.
And priest.
Say that again?
Priest.
Say that again?
Priest,
that's right. So even the language that we use can play into this way of relating to a spiritual guru. Okay, and finally, a guru is not a problem solver. So what do you think he means there? Again, this is Bhante being quite particular with his definitions. When he says problem, he has a thing particular.
It's notion of your responsibility again.
Yeah, something like that.
It's not someone who's going to swoop in and fix everything for you.
Yes. Yes, that's right.
Who's going to...
Yeah. And make your life all right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Or someone we can blame when the problem
when it doesn't resolved. Yes, yes, that's exactly right. That's what he's saying, actually, that often we want somebody to either fix it or to blame when it's not fixed. And either way, we're not taking responsibility for our lives, for our issues. And he says that you get this if you start, say, teaching meditation, you can get people relating to you as a problem solver. Well, you can get, you know, all of these actually. But he says, for an example of somebody can come up to you and say, I'm really lacking in energy. I'm really, really unable to function. You know, I can hardly get out of bed. I've just got this kind of lethargic, low energy. I'm trapped in it. You can say, or they say, well, I know that meditation will help me. And so you say, well, meditate. And they say, no, I haven't got the energy to do that. I can't, you know. And there's this kind of catch-22 that they can play. And what they're trying subconsciously, I think, to do, what Bhante says, is to trip you up and to then blame you. They're trying to sort of show that the guru doesn't know what they're doing. And then they complain. Bhante also distinguishes between a problem and a difficulty. Have you heard that distinction of his? Again, he's using the words in a very, very particular way. So what he's saying is that a difficulty can be solved on its own level by applying more effort. Yeah? A difficulty can be solved on its own level by applying more effort. So what would be an example of a difficulty that could be solved on its own level by applying more
effort? Learning to play an instrument?
Yeah, learning to play an instrument. It's difficult, but you practice and you become more proficient. Yeah? It's difficult, but you can make more effort. You can, and a lot of things in life, kind of, we can do that. Yeah.
Procrastination.
Yeah, procrastination. So you know, you can. So I procrastinate. So I can put little things in place in my life to sort of help me not procrastinate. You can make some effort and make some progress.
Financial difficulties?
Yeah, potentially. So it might be more that you need, you know, it depends on the circumstances, doesn't it? But it could be a difficulty, yeah. But a problem is something that can't be solved on its own level. This is Sangharakshita's definition. A problem is something that can't be solved on its own level. And if you make more effort, you just make it worse. You just tie the knot even tighter, right? Because you're pulling in the wrong way. Yeah? So a problem is something that can't be solved on its own level, that you need to find a different level of perspective where the problem sort of dissolves or isn't a problem. So what's an example of a problem?
Could it be that you cannot fix samsara?
Yeah.
You need to go outside of it.
Yeah. Yes, that's exactly it.
And the more you try to fix it.
Sure.
Just some satisfaction.
Yeah. So the problem of death, for example, we're not going to fix that problem on its own level. You know, no matter how good our health service is or becomes, it won't solve the problem of death or sickness. Those existential problems are not soluble at their own level, and you have to step outside of the whole samsaric perspective. That's one example.
So I don't know if this is good or simple.
Yeah.
Can be a simple of one blind person that wants to see. Is it a problem?
Somebody that's blind that wants to see, yes. That's right. And there's no way that can be solved on its own level. it's got to be transcended. If something like that disability of blindness, it's got to be transcended. It can't be solved on its own level. You know, very moving, again, watching some of the Paralympians and some of the blind sprinters. Incredible, actually. I mean, how they have the courage to sprint down the track. They're tied to a runner who can see. And very, very moving to kind of see somebody doing that. And that, for me, is an example of somebody transcending their disability. But not, you can't solve it on its own level. You sort of mean they've found another. So to go back to this, though, often we can want the guru to solve our problems. Yeah? To solve our problems. And they can't solve them for us. They might be able to, if they're a true guru, guide us into finding a different perspective where we can transcend the problem and reframe it. And maybe the problem stops being the problem that it was. But that's only because our mind has changed rather than the situation. Yeah. But yes, I'm going to move on to what a guru is. So this is what he isn't, or she isn't. They're not these four things. But what is a true guru? So what Bhante says here is, he says, to begin with, and perhaps above all else, the guru is one who stands on a higher level of being and consciousness than ourselves. Or to put it in a word, one who is more aware, one who is more evolved, one who is more developed. Yeah? So that's the first thing that he says about what a guru is. It's somebody who is standing on a higher level of consciousness than ourselves, a higher level of being than ourselves, one who is more developed, more aware, more evolved. He uses this language of evolution because he sees the spiritual life in terms of evolution. And he says that the spiritual life is us consciously evolving ourselves, not waiting for biology to do it, but consciously working on our own minds and becoming higher in terms of consciousness, at least.
Standing on a higher level of consciousness.
Yeah. So that's the first thing that he says a guru is. So let me just see if you've got any thoughts about that. Do we agree with that? Does that seem rather hierarchical?
Well, is a guru standing on a higher level of consciousness because they're more, because they're older, because they've been practicing longer? Or is it a virtue? Is it because they're wiser? Is it because they're more virtuous than us?
Hmm. What would you say?
I'd say it's because they have practiced. They have the conditions, or they've set the conditions to practice more skillfully, for longer and more skillfully and more wisely than we have. But you know, we may see that as a virtue anyway in itself.
But then it isn't just about time, is it?
Right.
Time
Right.
Yeah. Might,
hang on. Let's take one at a time. So, go on.
I was just going to say, surely then it's also something, again, coming back to experience, where you would have to judge whether somebody's on a higher level of consciousness. You would have to not become your mind too quickly.
Exactly.
You'd have to test that against your own experience.
You would. So that holds that. He'll come on to that in a moment. He'll say, well, how do you decide whether somebody is on a higher level? How do you judge that? But for the moment, let's just explore what does it mean for somebody to be on a higher level of consciousness of being, to be more aware, to be more evolved, to be more conscious. You were saying, Warren, that it might be that somebody's practiced for longer.
And deeper.
I don't know your name.
Molly.
You were saying that it's not just a question of time.
Yeah.
And that's true as well, isn't it? That just because somebody's practiced for longer, that doesn't mean that they're more developed. Practice isn't linear in that way. Mm. And some people who are very young have actually more insight, spiritual insight, than some people who are very old, and they may not have practiced for very long, at least in this lifetime.
That's related to how virtuous they are.
How virtuous. So virtue might be, something about... that's
they're younger,
go on.
Younger and they haven't practiced as long.
Yeah.
And that means that they have more something different than
you. Yeah.
It doesn't, on a spiritual level and on a mental level, everybody's equal.
Yeah.
So some people, younger or older, depending on that growth, maybe they can not guide you, but.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. I think when it comes to the spiritual life, you can't just go on age or number of years of practice or anything. But you can probably look at how virtuous they are. But if you look at how virtuous they are, even that's not obvious, because virtue can... real virtue isn't just about following the rules. And somebody might be behaving very well, and they're good, but in a rather moralistic way. So real ethics requires some inner purity. And again, you might not be able to discern that very easily. One might not be able to discern. But also what you said is that not everybody in the spiritual terms is equal. So does anybody disagree with that? Because that's quite a thing to say.
I think it's important. It's important. I think to make a difference between knowledge and wisdom.
Say that again. I didn't catch that.
The difference between knowledge.
Yeah.
Knowledge.
And wisdom. Yeah.
I think a guru.
Yeah.
Is we're speaking about guru.
Yeah.
We're speaking about wisdom.
Yeah, we are. Not about knowledge. That's true.
But
let me just go back to the question. I just want to see if we can explore this question about whether everybody is spiritually equal, or whether it's valid to say that some people are more spiritually developed than others. How does that ring with you, sit with you, that question?
I think there's a distinction between capacity. I think we're all equal in our spiritual capacity.
Yeah.
Maybe not in terms of like right in this life, but like as beings or as consciousness.
Right.
But I don't think that necessarily people are at the same sort of continuum spiritually. So there's a difference where you're at and what you're capable of.
I think that's... that's possibly what I think Bhante is getting at as well. I think what the Buddha said, for example, is that all human beings have the potential for enlightenment. So it's potential. But not all human beings have realised that potential to an equal level. Yeah? And I think that's what the Buddha would say. So you've got this distinction between potential and realisation of that potential. It's a tricky one, because somebody isn't as developed spiritually, that doesn't mean that you can just kind of look down on them and patronise them or see them as lesser human beings, because actually they've got this potential. All beings are potential Buddhas from a Buddhist perspective. So you've got to respect that potential. At the same time, if we went around thinking that all beings were equal in their wisdom or realization of that potential, then how would we ever develop? Because if everybody's equal, then that means that nobody can develop. There's no movement. Yeah? There's no movement possible. As soon as you admit that there's the potential for growth and development, then you've got to admit that some people might have grown more or developed more in some directions.
Can I ask a question? What does it look like? What does someone who's spiritually developed
look like
in contrast to someone who isn't?
Yeah, I don't really know if there's an easy answer to that.
Kinder.
Well, yeah, but even kindness isn't always what we... It might not look very kind at times. I think there would be something about congruence, which is that they would act consistently in all situations, in all with all people, as it were. There would be a consistency to them. I think you could look at the precepts in Buddhism and look at their behaviour against those precepts, and kindness being, in a way, the main one.
Kindness.
Not sentimental kindness, that's
like
right.
Yeah.
You could look at them in relation to the precepts. Go on.
Sorry, I'm just thinking about the word hierarchy. A spiritual hierarchy is coming to me.
Well, that's exactly the word that Bhante uses. He differentiates between a power hierarchy and a spiritual hierarchy. Can you say what you had in mind?
I suppose I don't like the word whichever way it comes.
Whichever way it comes, exactly.
Yeah.
So what?
That's something I've never even thought of.
No, exactly. But it's very, very common, this distaste for. So can you? I wonder if you can say what you don't like about it, because I think it's quite common to not like it.
The lack of that some people are worth more or more of more value somewhere along the line than others, and that doesn't really sit well.
So that's right. So one of the things that we can easily associate with the word hierarchy is that sense that some people are worth more, and therefore some people are worth less, and therefore they can be dismissed. Now that is an example, I think, of a power hierarchy, where we're judging somebody's worth in that way. But Bhante differentiates that sort of negative hierarchy from a natural hierarchy of spiritual development. And in spiritual development, one of the things you have to remember is that everybody's got equal potential, and therefore you can't judge somebody's worth as lesser or greater, because potential is equal, if you see what I mean. But you can judge somebody's qualities. And if we don't judge somebody's qualities and behaviour, and we refuse to make any judgments about them, then what we lose is our capacity to discriminate and make wise choices. Yeah? So, for example, well, the Paralympics or the Olympics are really, really good examples of some people excelling at particular activities. And none of us could say that they're equal. You know, I couldn't run 100 metres. I was going to say, well, I might not be able to run 100 metres at all. I certainly couldn't run it in the time that people in the Olympics or even the Paralympics ran. Yeah. So it would be sort of folly and delusional for me to assume that I can sprint as fast as one of the Olympians. That doesn't make me a lesser person in terms of worth. Do you see what I mean? But it does make me quite a different... There is a difference, and that difference needs to be recognised.
But wasn't the Buddha completely non-judgmental?
Mm. In terms of people's potential, but not in terms of people's behaviour or their qualities. No, he was very, very willing to discriminate. He was very willing to say, for example, that, you know, like getting angry is not going to help you on the way to enlightenment. And he was able to chastise that monk and saying, don't do that, which is a judgment about a particular behaviour. But he wouldn't dismiss the person and their potential just because their behaviour wasn't conducive to enlightenment. There's a difference. Yeah? And I think we need to learn this difference, because our society, sort of rightly and for very good reasons, values egalitarianism and equal opportunity, and that's really, there's something really worth celebrating in that. Our culture tries to at least move towards values like equal opportunities, etc. But I think we can easily then assume that that means that we can't make any judgments about anything, or to at least in public, because privately we'll be making judgments all the time. You can't move without making a judgment. But it can be a no-no to sometimes make judgments in public. And actually, we need to have our judgmental and critical faculty alive to make wise choices, but without dismissing human beings as human beings and their potential, without slipping into disdain or unkindness.
Does it come down to the criteria you use to judge, basically? So that unhelpful judgments are based on, you know, in our society, on someone's wealth or their position or their appearance.
Yeah.
Whereas, are you saying that you should judge on people's... Well, what would be helpful criteria to judge on? Is it their... behaviour?
Depends what we want to achieve, but if we're trying to develop spiritually, and we're looking around us to see if there are other people who can help us develop spiritually, then probably you want to judge them across against their behaviour in ethical terms, their sort of congruence against what they say and how they behave. You know, is there that sort of congruence in terms of their kindness, and or whether they slip into unkindness? Ethics is a good criteria. Sure. It's a good criteria. With a caveat, that I've not met anybody who's ethically completely perfect. So if our standards are of perfection, you might not ever meet somebody that you're prepared to learn from. Yeah. So certainly in the Triratna Buddhist community, I've never met anybody who's completely perfect. And so you have to apply some sort of pragmatism and say, I can learn some things from this person, acknowledging that they've got their faults and their failings themselves.
Can I say
something? I'm going to move on. So you can just ask, if it's a question around that.
Well,
otherwise, I want to move on.
Relevant. Yeah.
Go on.
Since we all live with a specific time limit, there are not as many gurus as there are humans.
Yeah.
So therefore, there is always a judgment being done. Like, guru will judge whether he will want to be your guru or not, right? Or.
Well, in a way I'm saying that we do need to make judgments. We do need to make judgments. And if we're just sticking to a spiritual, our discourse to a spiritual path, then we do need to make judgments about is this person worth listening to? Is this path worth following? Do these practices work for me? Does this seem a real spiritual situation or not? And we need that critical judgment faculty alive. Yeah. Okay, so that's... We're still on this thing of what a guru is. So a guru is somebody that's on this more spiritually developed, more conscious, more alive. Then he says that in the second place, a guru is somebody with whom we have contact. In that if we don't come into contact with them, then they can't be a guru for us. That contact might not be just physical contact. It could be through words that they've written or spoken, or it might be on a purely mental level. It could be even in dreams, he says. But normally, for most of us, it would be physical contact. And he says that actually you need quite a lot of that. But that thirdly, he says that contact needs to be existential. What he means by this is it's not just contact based on how you doing, isn't the weather nice, how's your weekend. Not that isn't allowed, but the relationship can't be based on that. The contact has to be based on something really meaningful about the human condition, about the existential situation, for it to be a guru that you're relating to. And I'm going to move on quite quickly now. So, and fourthly, what he says is that it's not the guru's business to teach anything. So this goes back to the guru, the true guru, not being a teacher. He says it's not the guru's business to teach the disciple anything. It's the guru's business to be himself or herself in relation to the disciple. Yeah? And it's not the business of the disciple as such to learn. What he or she has to do is simply expose himself or herself to the being and to the effect of the being of the guru, and at the same time be themselves in relation to them. So what you've got is two individuals trying to be themselves, coming into existential contact, and that is enough. The relationship is enough. And if one of those people is more developed, spiritually, then you've got this guru-disciple relationship happening. Okay. So yeah, what Banti goes on to distinguish between is different types of communication. He says that there's horizontal communication and there's vertical communication. And when you're relating to somebody that's more developed than yourself, then there's a verticality to the communication. And you don't have to be too self-conscious about that. You just have to be yourself. And if they're themselves, and you're relating on the basis of what matters, then that means that the disciple learns and grows. And he says that in a sense, the guru also grows. Not in the same way as the disciple grows, but in some ways the guru also evolves through that contact. He says in the Tibetan tantric tradition, it's said that the guru needs the disciple in order to evolve. So he concludes by saying... that for most of us, we need human relationships, we need contact and communication to grow. It's not completely 100% true. There might be people who can grow without that. But for most of us, we need contact and communication and human relationships. And for most of us, we need somebody who's a little bit further or more developed spiritually, more conscious, more aware, and contact and real relationship with them. And that's what leads to us growing. simply by us being ourselves in that relationship and them being themselves, there's growth.
You just mean that we need a guru, find a guru to be better gurus?
He says that you certainly need a guru. If you take a guru to be somebody who's more developed and more conscious, and then you need contact and real relationship with them. And he's saying for most people that's what they will need. And it's not axiomatic, because you can imagine somebody just developing on their own. But for most people they will need contact with somebody that's more developed. If that's how you term a guru, then yes.
So every one of us?
Every one of us.
To find a guru.
Every one of us needs that contact with somebody more developed. Probably. Mostly.
But in a sense, surely what we're doing here is that, then, because
it
we're
is.
Talking about things.
It is, in a certain sense.
People that are more spiritually developed,
yeah.
And people who are less, that's exactly.
That's right. Well, that's what the spiritual community contains, hopefully, is people of different levels of experience coming into real contact, existential contact, and friendship, and learning from that, growing from that. That's what the spiritual community is ideally about. And that's what Bhante's vision of the Sangha is. Yeah? That's exactly
it.
I
don't have to be in a relation one-to-one. I mean...
Sorry, I'm going to move on.
I'm going to move on.
So, simply because I want to finish with what he says about himself in this context. So Bhante is the founder of the Tri Ratna order and community. And in 1990, he gave this paper that says, that's called My Relation to the Order. And in this paper, he refers back to this earlier lecture, Is a Guru Necessary? So he's talking about himself in relation to the order, in relation to this. And this sort of summarizes the lecture a bit. So he says, in this lecture, I did three things. Firstly, I tried to explain what a guru was not. He or she, for there is a female of the species, was not the head of a religious group, not a teacher. That is, not one who imparts knowledge and information, not even religious knowledge and information, and not a father or mother substitute, and not a problem solver. Secondly, I tried to explain what a guru was. He was one who stood on a higher level of being and consciousness than we did, one with whom we were in regular contact, one, whatever plane... Sorry, on whatever plane, and one between whom and ourselves there was an existential contact and communication. Finally, and we didn't really get to this, I compared Eastern and Western attitudes towards the guru. In the East, I suggested, the guru was sometimes overvalued, and in the West, usually undervalued. The proper course was to follow a middle way between these two extremes, simply recognizing that there were others who were more highly evolved than ourselves, and that we could evolve through contact with them. What was required was not absolute faith, but contact and receptivity. In this way, did I attempt, in effect, to revise the guru concept and rid the word guru of its unpleasant connotation. And then he goes on to say, but the tide was against me, and now, 20 years on, I would drop the guru concept, and as I have said, preferably not apply the word guru to myself, nor have it applied to me by others. So he 20 years later, he was saying, look, he didn't really succeed in redefining the word guru, and now he'd rather not use it at all for himself or have it applied to him. And he then goes on to say, we have in Buddhism the wonderful term spiritual friend. And this I am more than content to apply to myself and to have applied to me by others. Indeed, there are times when I think that spiritual friend is almost too much, and just the word friend would be enough. The English word spiritual is in any case not the exact equivalent of the Indian word Kalyana. According to the Pali English Dictionary, Kalyana means beautiful, charming, auspicious, helpful, and morally good. Obviously, I cannot claim to be beautiful, at least not in the literal sense. And I can hardly be described as charming, though I may be auspicious and helpful on occasion, and morally good to some extent. Let me, therefore, be content with the appellation friend, and stand to the order simply in relation of friend. So that's how Bantu's thinking evolved, and in a way I think that really summarises and concludes what he means when he says is a guru necessary. Yeah. So we'll leave it there for this week. Next week we're on the urban retreat, so that means the class happens, but we've got a special evening. Every evening's a special evening, but next week, come. And Subhadra Mathi is going to be interviewing me. I'm not quite sure what about. but it'll be sort of Subhadra Mathi and me in conversation next week. Yeah? Good. So hopefully see you then. Thank you.
Thanks, mate.